pounds of arsenic preserving powder over them while they were in my place. Smith allowed himself a small smile. Was this before the autopsy, when the stomachs were put in the jar for chemical exaggeration?
Why, of course it was,
Cutler answered, as if astonished at being asked such a question. Tell me, Mr. Cutler, said Smith, why have you waited until now to make this fact known?
No one ever asked me, Cutler exclaimed. That's why I didn't tell about the arsenic. When the bodies of the woman and the three children were brought to me the morning after the fire, nobody said anything to me about anything being wrong. All they told me was to get the bodies ready for shipment to Chicago, as they were to be buried there. Anyone knows that in my business we have to embalm bodies for shipment. The railroad will not receive them otherwise. I could not embalm in the ordinary way because the bodies were burned so badly, so I just scattered a lot of arsenic over them.
Though Cutler's testimony clearly helped the state in one regard, by offering an alternate explanation for the arsenic found in the corpses, it failed to account for the presence of the lethal dose of strychnine. Warden immediately put Dr. Haynes back on the stand and asked if strychnine was used in embalming fluids or preservatives.
Strychnine has no antiseptic or preservative qualities, answered the chemist.
Haynes's reply undid some of the damage done by Cutler. Overall, however, he turned out to be such a disappointing witness that, in its daily coverage of the trial, the Detroit Free Press reported his testimony under the headline, Defense Expert Aids Prosecution. Haynes's failure to definitely state that the four persons whose bodies were found in the ruins came to their end by poisoning rather than suffocation and burning was more than a setback for the defense. It was, wrote the paper, a death blow. 38. Closing Arguments. On Wednesday, November 25th, in honor of the impending holiday, the Argus Bulletin devoted the middle of its front page to a piece titled, Why We Are Thankful, by the Reverend John B. Donaldson, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church. After paying tribute to the New England Puritans, those stern and stalwart souls who established Thanksgiving Day, and to Abraham Lincoln who proclaimed it a national holiday, Donaldson offered thanks for America's civic, commercial, and political institutions, its upstanding elected officials, and its just and sensible citizenry. Looking closer to home, he gave thanks for the continuing betterment of LaPorte, for the influence of her schools and her public spirit, for her growing factories and widening markets, for the lanes that will be boulevarded and the macadam highways that will gridiron the county, for the shrubs that will beautify her waste places, and for a water plant that will furnish good drinking water before the wells shall produce a pestilence. Most of all, he was thankful to the Lord for having lifted a terrible curse from his beloved community. We praise God for the conflagration of the Scarlet House whose visitors' feet took hold on the earthly hell. With heartfelt gratitude, he foresaw the approaching day when our scandals shall cease to heat the wires of two continents, when the Gunness case was a thing of the past, and LaPorte was restored to its former blessed obscurity. Occupying the front page along with Reverend Donaldson's essay was Harry Burr Darling's daily report on the trial. With the testimony finished and final arguments about to begin, he summed up the situation with one of his usual overwrought metaphors. On this day, the 25th of November, is being fought the real battle for the life of Ray Lanphier. 4 days were required to decide upon a jury, a board of reviewers. 10 days more were consumed in the taking of evidence. During these 10 days, each side built its fleet. The prosecution constructed a powerful first-class battleship. The defense adopted different tactics, relying on a multitude of small craft, such as torpedo boats and submarines, to do the damage, and so harassed the maneuvers of the enemy as to render it incapable of infliction of serious damage. As of yet, concluded Darling, the armor of the big warship has proved of sufficient thickness to resist the fire of innumerable theories from the opposing flotilla. Martin Sutherland,
Prosecutor Smith's co-counsel, was the first to address the jury that day. Appealing to the jurors' good common sense, he began by mocking the defense's contention that the female body found in the ashes was not Bell's. Joe Maxson's testimony proved that, besides the hired hand himself, Bell and her three children were the only ones in the house on the night of the fire. The next morning, there were found four bodies in the debris. Ordinary common sense would lead us to believe that those were the bodies who inhabited that dwelling. As for the teeth, they were not false teeth easily removed, but bridge work fastened to the natural teeth of Mrs. Ganesse. Yet the defense has asked you to run with the imagination of Mr. Hudson, who testified that he recognized Mrs. Ganesse even with two veils over her face, said Sutherland with an audible sneer. It's very probable, isn't it, that Belle Ganesse would come to LaPorte, hire a livery wagon, and drive out to the scene of her murders. Gentlemen of the jury, your common sense teaches you better. And by using that same common sense, you will realize that we have established the corpus delicti beyond a reasonable doubt. Turning next to the question of motive, Sutherland, his voice still laced with sarcasm, described the seemingly genial defendant as a man driven to exact murderous vengeance on his former lover, both for betraying him with Helgeline and for reneging on a promise of hush money after he witnessed the murder of the North Dakotan. "Testimony we have introduced," said Sutherland, "shows that Lamphere, the easy-going Lamphere, the hard-drinking Lamphere, the fellow about town, had an easy berth out with Mrs. Ganesse. Testimony further shows that Andrew Helgeline supplanted Lamphere in Mrs. Ganesse's affections. This caused jealousy in the suspicious Lamphere, who did not want to trade his cozy berth with Mrs. Ganesse for a hard bed offered by Liz Smith. On the night of January 14th, Helgeline disappeared, never to be seen alive again," continued Sutherland. "Lamphere did not stay at Michigan City, as Mrs. Ganesse had instructed him. The scene that he saw that night was such as to satisfy his desire of getting Helgeline out of the way. A compact was probably made over the body of Helgeline. What that was, we have no positive evidence, but we have a right to infer that she agreed to pay him money. From receipts, it was evident that there was no money due him for labor, yet his whole cry was that she owed him money, and he would get even with her. The woman did not abide by this compact, did not pay Lamphere enough of the blood money, and the morning of April 28th, Lamphere applied the torch to her house, sending her and her children to an awful death in a fiery furnace." Lamphere's behavior immediately prior to the conflagration left no doubt about his guilt, argued Sutherland. "We find on the day before the fire, Mrs. Ganesse was tracked by Lamphere," Sutherland stated. "Mrs. Ganesse, weeping, entered Minich's store and bought some groceries. Lamphere, as an excuse for entrance, bought a 5-cent plug of tobacco. Lamphere followed Mrs. Ganesse out of the store, glaring at Mrs. Ganesse. What is the evidence now to show that Lamphere committed the crime on the morning of April 28th? We find Lamphere skulking and hiding before the fire started, then again after the fire started. We find Lamphere flatly contradicting himself in the stories he told to Deputy Sheriff Marr and Deputy Sheriff Antis. First he told one thing, and then he told another to the various officers. Finally, he practically made a confession of arson to Deputy Antis." "It is enough," cried Sutherland, raising his voice for the first time. Sutherland concluded with a dig at his opponents. "Now, as to the defense," he said with a dismissive shrug, "if you are able to tell what it is, you can do better than the prosecution. They would attempt to prove by one witness that she was alive and by the next witness that she was dead. By one witness they attempt to show that the teeth were clipped off and left in the fire. By another witness they attempt to show that they were not her teeth. The expert testified that he found poison in the mass of the stomachs, and Mr. Cutler testified that poisonous fluids were used in the bodies. From all these facts," concluded Sutherland, returning to his starting point, "we ask you to sum up the whole matter and use your common sense.
Next up was Wirt Warden's co-counsel, Ellsworth Weir, son of a prominent local politician who had served both as a two-term state senator and mayor of LaPorte. Weir was lucky to be there at all. Several years earlier, while representing a pretty young Cleveland woman, Mrs. Louise Brill, in a divorce suit, he had been shot at point-blank range by her estranged husband, Joseph, an immensely rich mine owner who accused the attorney of being unduly intimate with his wife and stealing her affections. Newspapers throughout the Midwest reported that the wound was probably fatal. Under the ministrations of a LaPorte physician, however, Weir eventually made a full recovery. Now, attacking Sutherland for allowing a case of such vital importance to degenerate into sarcasm, Weir angrily accused his opponent of the greatest legal somersault of the present century. For all his talk about common sense, Sutherland himself had taken a flight into the realms of fancy, spinning a purely imaginary tale about Lamphere's involvement in Andrew Helgeline's murder. He pictures the scene when Lamphere sees Mrs. Ganesse killing Helgeline, Weir said derisively, and then because they are partners in crime, they want to kill each other. It was possible, Weir conceded, that Mrs. Ganesse had a confederate who assisted in her crimes, and who eventually had a purpose in getting rid of her. But the theory that Lamphere was her accomplice was merely a guess, and you cannot guess this defendant into the penitentiary or hang him by guessing. Turning to the issue of the teeth, Weir demanded to know why the prosecution had not produced the miner Louis Schultz. Where is he now? Why do they not bring him here? The most important witness. He also wondered why Dr. Norton had made a diagram of the teeth and provided it to Sheriff Smutzer 2 weeks before the teeth were found. In that amount of time, Weir suggested darkly, a fake set could have been made and substituted. And what about the poison that Mr. Sutherland brushes away with a wave of his hand? Granted that the undertaker used a pure arsenic powder, said Weir, yet the eminent Dr. Haynes testified that there was strychnine sufficient to have killed 3 people. For Lamphere to have committed the crime of murder, it would have been necessary for him to have gone into the house, administered the poison, and then carried Mrs. Ganesse and her 3 children into the cellar and set fire to the building. But Lamphere could not have gained admission to that house. It was locked up tight. As Weir drew near the end of his remarks, his voice grew hoarse with emotion. "That a crime was committed, we all agree," he said, "and as good citizens we feel that if the criminal can be apprehended, he should be convicted. But I do not believe that Ray Lamphere is guilty of the crime which is charged against him. So far as Ray Lamphere is concerned, there is no evidence that he did anything except occasionally to drink. And many men drink. Ray Lamphere may be ever so bad, but he did not commit this crime, and as he did not, he should be freed by you gentlemen." By the time Weir reached his closing words, tears were coursing down his cheeks. "Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. You of the jury go home tomorrow, your task completed, to the hearts of your families. This man, if you condemn him, will have nothing before him. Think, think long and hard before you seal the doom of a human life." Warden, who spoke next, delivered what was by all accounts a moving appeal on behalf of his client. Before a body of his peers, a man could have pled for his own life with no greater force, wrote one observer. He fought for the prisoner as though the prisoner was his own brother. His powerful speech inspired a particularly head-scratching tribute from Harry Burr Darling, who praised the defense lawyer for leaving no table unturned to make the jury fireproof against the blazing bonfires in the face of Prosecutor Smith. Warden began by reminding the jurors of the concept of reasonable doubt. "This case against Ray Lamphere is entirely built up of circumstantial evidence,"
he stressed. Therefore, you must be satisfied that there is no other reasonable explanation of the evidence than the one presented in the indictment that Lamphere is guilty. Otherwise, he is entitled to be acquitted.
Every point the prosecution had made, Warden argued, was open to doubt, beginning with its claim that Mrs. Ganesse had died in the fire.
I firmly believe she is alive, Warden asserted. She had abundant motive for the commission of this crime, in the coming of Ursula Helgeline to find out about his brother. She made preparation for the fire. Even in her will, she made provision for the disposal of her property in the event of the death of all her children. I am honest in saying that I believe the statement of D.M. Hudson and the two little girls. What of the four bodies? He continued. I believe it impossible for four bodies to fall from the second story and still to be found together, laid out in regular rows. The remains of the piano were found on top of the bodies. If we are to believe the state, those bodies falling from the second floor beat the piano to the basement.
By way of planting even more doubt in the minds of the jurors, Warden proffered a startling new suggestion, that Joe Maxson was somehow complicit in Mrs. Ganesse's sinister scheme.
I am of the opinion that Joe Maxson knows more than he has been willing to tell. I believe he had his clothes on all night. There was no yelling, no cry of fire, no calling of the neighbors.
In regard to the teeth, Warden dismissed Dr. Norton's testimony as prejudiced.
I say to you that these teeth never went through the fire, he exclaimed.
Everything connected to them, from the manner in which they were found to the condition in which they are now, suggested that they were part of a diabolical plot to convince the world that Mrs. Ganesse had perished in the flames. Warden went on to dispute the testimony of John Rye, who said Lamphere went back to the Ganesse home on January 14th and read aloud a statement by Lamphere that denied this. His final words were delivered with a ringing intensity of feeling.
They say that Lamphere made damaging admissions. Suppose you agree that Lamphere lied to Antis. Would you hang him for lying? Then we must all prepare for death. But I believe if you act as your conscience dictates and according to the law and the evidence, there will be no question about your verdict.
State's Attorney Smith was the last to speak. In contrast to the impassioned tones of the defense attorneys, he began in an easy, conversational style, eschewing histrionics, at least for the moment.
I'm not here to make a political speech, he told the jurors. I want to talk to you a little bit about this case. I'm going to show you beyond a reasonable doubt that Lamphere set fire to the house and burned up those people.
Like his co-counsel, Smith dismissed the defense arguments as hopelessly confused.
I cannot conceive on what theory the defense is trying this case, he said. One moment they say Belle Ganesse is alive, and the next that she is dead.
Addressing Warden's charge that the evidence against Lamphere was entirely circumstantial, he repeated the line he had used in his opening statement.
Of course the evidence is circumstantial, he exclaimed. When men start out to burn houses or commit crimes, they do not give notice nor go around with a brass band.
Smith responded to another of Warden's accusations by leveling one of his own.
Where is Lewis Schultz, they ask? Well, we ask, where is Nigger Liz? Why don't they establish an alibi by her? What was the defendant doing during the 1 hour and 45 minutes which, according to his own statement, was consumed in going a mile and a quarter? If the time that has been stated is not correct, why don't they bring in Nigger Liz? She knows. Why don't they bring her in?
Where is there any evidence that Dr. Norton told anything but the absolute truth about the teeth? Smith continued. When the defense's own dental experts testified, they stated that the teeth had been made for and had been worn in the same mouth, and further, that they had been through the fire.
Like Sutherland, he scoffed at Daniel Hudson's claim that Belle was easily recognizable, despite the two veils hanging down to her chin. Next, he briefly recapped his reasons for believing that Lamphere was complicit in Andrew Helgeline's murder. Then, in a moment made even more dramatic by the sudden shift in tone, he swiveled away from the jury box, jabbed a finger at Lamphere, and thundered, "What did you tell John Rye you would get even with the old woman for? Why did you tell Deputy Sheriff Antis that you would plead guilty of arson were it not for the sake of your poor old mother? Why were you running around the Gunner's place at night and then pleading guilty to being out there and paying fines for trespass?" As Ray struggled, with limited success, to appear unshaken by this onslaught, Smith turned back to the jurors. Though the state had devoted much of its time to proving that Mrs. Gunness was murdered, Smith made it clear that he cared little about the woman. She was, after all, rottener than hell. No, his feelings were for the three innocent children, slain by a man who hides behind towers and sneaks about and sets a fire with such consequences. His final words, which rang with righteous indignation, could hardly fail to stir the blood of his listeners, most of whom were parents themselves. "I say to you that if you don't believe Lamphere is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, then don't bring in a verdict of guilty. I do not ask you to vindicate that bad woman, but I have a right to plead in the name of God on behalf of those three innocent children." In his instructions to the jury, Judge Richter defined reasonable doubt, stressed that the defendant's failure to testify should raise no presumption of any kind against him, and explained that circumstantial evidence was to be regarded as quite as conclusive in its convincing power as direct and positive evidence. He then told the jurors that, under the law, they could bring in one of several verdicts: guilty of murder in the first degree, death; guilty of murder in the first degree, life sentence; guilty of murder in the second degree, life sentence; guilty of manslaughter, 2 to 21 years. Guilty of arson, 2 to 21 years. Not guilty. It took Richter 15 minutes to read his instructions. At 5:30 p.m., Thanksgiving Eve, the jurors filed out of the courtroom to begin their deliberations. 39. Verdict. After 5 hours of heated debate and 4 divided ballots, it was clear that the jurors were not about to reach a quick decision. At 10:45 p.m., they knocked off for the night, resuming their deliberations after breakfast on Thanksgiving Day. Twice that day they requested additional information from Judge Richter. Twice they were told that the court could do nothing more than reread the instructions to them. Both times, the 12 men filed back into the courtroom, took their seats in the jury box, and listened intently while Judge Richter read through his instructions in their entirety. By then, rumors had spread that jury was deadlocked. As the 12 men continued their deliberations into the afternoon, the rest of the participants dispersed for their holiday meals, and the lights of the emptied courtroom were extinguished. As dusk came on, a group of newspapermen, milling about on the street, awaiting a decision, saw the courtroom windows suddenly light up from within. Word spread rapidly that a verdict was about to be returned, and people came swarming. The room was nearly filled when it became clear that the crowd had responded to a false alarm. Deputy Sheriff Antis, entertaining some out-of-town friends curious to see the site of the notorious trial, had brought them up to the courtroom and turned on the lights. Finally, at approximately 7 p.m., 15 minutes after returning from supper, and 26 hours after beginning their deliberations, the jurors sent word to Bailiff Matz that they had come to a decision on their 19th ballot. After notifying Judge Richter and the attorneys by telephone, Matz switched on the courtroom lights. By the time Richter and the lawyers arrived, the room was packed, every seat occupied, people standing in the aisle and lining the walls. A few minutes later, Lamphere was brought over from the jail by Deputy Sheriff Antis, who seated himself directly behind the prisoner to ensure that Ray did not make any undue movements upon hearing the verdict. At 7:20, the jurors filed inside and took their seats in the jury box, and the court was called to order.
"Gentlemen of the jury, have you reached an agreement?" asked the judge.
Rising to his feet, Foreman Henry Mills confirmed that they had, but said that he wished to make a statement before the verdict was read. Judge Richter replied that he was not at liberty to hear any statement until the verdict was received and read. A tense few moments of silence ensued as Foreman Mills passed the white slip of paper to Bailiff Matz, who handed it to Judge Richter. After entering the verdict upon the docket, Richter cleared his voice and read, "We find the defendant guilty of arson." The crowd, having been warned that no demonstration would be tolerated, heard the verdict in silence. Ray appeared to flush, then grow pale, and those watching him closely noticed a slight tremor of his hands. Otherwise, he showed no reaction. His attorneys, however, who seemed to take the blow harder than the prisoner himself, started forward as though about to offer an angry protest before checking themselves. Having read the verdict, Judge Richter asked Foreman Mills if he still cared to make his statement, but Mills declined the offer, saying that it would do no good now. After receiving the thanks of the judge and Prosecutor Smith for their careful and conscientious consideration of the case, the 12 men were discharged, and Lamphere was ordered to stand.
"Do you have any reasons to state why sentence should not be pronounced upon you?" asked Judge Richter.
Ray, his face haggard, his eyes downcast, his hands held before him, as if his wrists were still shackled, slowly replied,
"I have nothing to say at this time."
With that, Judge Richter sentenced him to the state prison in Michigan City for an indeterminate term of 2 to 21 years, fined him $5,000, and disenfranchised him for 5 years. The court then instructed the deputy sheriff to escort him back to the county jail. With a fair degree of hyperbole and a certain civic pride in his city's newfound notoriety, Edward Molloy of the LaPorte Weekly Herald declared that Ray's conviction brought to a close one of the most famous murder trials in the history of the world. In every city, every town, and every hamlet, and even at the crossroads, in fact places, no matter how remote, to which the telegraph, the mails, and the newspapers had access, the people were watching the trial. They had followed the case from its beginning. They had devoured every line printed by the newspapers, and they had formed theories on the various features of the case. The newspapers and the news associations were wild to get all the news that was to be had. Within 2 minutes after Judge Richter read the verdict, it was flashed by wire to all points of the compass. The cables carried the news to Europe and to other foreign lands. Interviewed in his cell that night by Molloy, Ray seemed reconciled to his fate.
"It could have been worse," he said. "I don't have any particular complaint. The evidence was pretty strong against me, so I'm willing to take my medicine. Sure, I was hoping for an acquittal, but my conscience is clear, and that helps some."
Hoping to settle some of the controversial questions raised during the trial, Molloy asked Ray why he didn't arouse the people when you saw the fire that morning if you didn't set it.
"Well," said Ray, "I suppose if I'd realized what was going to happen, and knew what I know now, I guess I would have done so. I got scared and did things I shouldn't have done, and that made it look bad."
"Do you believe Mrs. Ganesh is dead or alive?" Molloy asked.
"Oh, she's dead all right," said Ray. "That was her body and the children they found in the fire."
"Tell me this, Ray," said Molloy. "What did you really see that night you returned from Michigan City, the night Helgeline disappeared?"
Ray was emphatic.
"I didn't see anything," he said.
Molloy tried pressing him for more details on the matter, but at that point Ray clammed up, explaining that his attorney, Wirt Warden, had told him not to make any admissions.
"But what does it matter, now that you've been convicted?" said Molloy. "They can't try you again."
Ray only shook his head and repeated that he was following his lawyer's instructions. Once Molloy was gone, Ray asked Sheriff Smutzer for a sheet of paper, a pen, and some ink, and composed a letter to his mother. "Dear Mother," he began, "I will try and write you a few lines to let you know how I am. I just got back from the courthouse where I went to get my sentence. I was somewhat disappointed, although the circumstances were against me, but, Ma, I am not guilty, and before God I am no criminal, even if I am in the eyes of the people. Don't worry about me, Ma, for it might have been worse. I have thought many times since I have been here in jail that it is a wonder I did not find a resting place in her private burying ground. So, Ma, do not worry, for I am among the living with a clear conscience, and know I never did any very great wrong to anybody. Now, Ma, I know you are almost heartbroken, but try and console yourself in the fact that I am innocent. Of course, it is hard for me, but not half as hard as it would be if I were guilty. Now, Ma, cheer up," he concluded. "Don't worry about me, and I will see you sometime. Goodbye from your son, Ray." With the trial behind him, Ray, relieved of the tension of uncertainty, slept soundly Thursday night. The letter had not yet been mailed the following morning when Ray was brought into Sheriff Smutzer's office. Moments later, his mother and his sister, Mrs. Pearl Steele, entered, the pair having traveled by train from South Bend to bid him goodbye. Sheriff Smutzer made his office available for the sad occasion. Supported by her daughter, the 70-year-old woman burst into tears as she embraced her boy.
"Ray, I know you are innocent," she said between sobs. "Your mother still believes in you."
Ray's eyes moistened, but otherwise he kept control of his emotions. Moments later, knowing that she might not live to see her wayward son again, the 70-year-old woman was led from the office in a state of near collapse. Lamphere might have accepted his fate with equanimity, but the same could not be said of Wirt Wharton, who gave free vent to his outrage. Speaking to reporters at the jail that morning, he denounced the verdict as ridiculous. "There were absolutely no grounds and no evidence to support," he said bitterly. "We're going to make a motion for a new trial on Monday. If that's denied, we'll take the appeal to the Supreme Court." No one doubted Wharton's sincerity, though an appeal seemed unlikely. To begin with, there was the expense, $500 for a transcript alone. Moreover, it would take at least 2 years for the case to reach the state Supreme Court, and by that time, as the Herald noted, the minimum term of Lamphere's sentence would have expired, and it would be better to work for his release on parole. Even if the decision were reversed on appeal and the state declined to retry the case, Ray could hardly count on walking away a free man, since Smith had made it clear that he was prepared to bring charges against Lamphere for the murder of Andrew Helgelein. The consensus among observers was that, once their emotions had cooled, Ray's lawyers would realize that their client, by mere chance, had escaped a more severe punishment, and that the best thing for Lamphere to do is to accept the verdict as gracefully as possible. The jury's decision, it emerged, had been a compromise between 10 men who favored a verdict of murder in the second degree with a penalty of life imprisonment, and 2 stubborn holdouts, one who argued for a verdict of arson, one who wanted to acquit. Among editorial writers in newspapers throughout the Midwest, the consensus was that the decision made little legal or logical sense. In the words of one typical commentator, the result of the trial was peculiar. According to the judgment of the jury, Lamphere was guilty of arson, but was acquitted of the charge of murdering Mrs. Ganesh and her children, who were incinerated in the conflagration. It imposes a severe strain upon the imagination to conceive how it would be possible for the defendant to be adjudged guilty of arson without being convicted of murder also. Under the circumstances, the return of a verdict of arson is a travesty of justice, and cannot be viewed as being anything other than almost absurdly inconsistent. Apart from his diehard defenders, virtually everyone seemed to feel that the jury had let Lamphere off easy. One wisecracking writer for the Chicago Daily News remarked that, had Mrs. Ganesh been on trial instead of Lamphere, the jury would have probably found her guilty of nothing worse than operating an unlicensed graveyard. There was one editorialist who felt differently. He agreed that Lamphere should have been found guilty of murder, but, at least when it came to the ogress, there was no reason for the jury to impose a harsh sentence. If Lamphere took the life of Belle Ganesse, the writer opined, he should have been presented with a gold medal. Early Friday afternoon, Ray was taken by interurban streetcar to Michigan City. Along with Sheriff Smutzer, he was accompanied by several newspapermen. He chatted easily with them, repeatedly remarking that he was going to prison with a clear conscience. When one of the reporters asked what he meant by that, Ray replied, "I didn't do any more than hundreds of other people would have done in my place," a comment that, to the ears of his listeners, sounded very near to a confession. On the whole, he seemed relaxed, even surprisingly cheerful, at one point whistling, "Wait till the sun shines, Nelly," while gazing out the window. A car was waiting at the Michigan City streetcar stop to drive him the rest of the way. "I'm lucky to be here," he mused aloud as the prison came into view. "Mighty lucky. Why, I might have been chopped up and put in a hole in old woman Ganesse's chicken yard." With Smutzer still at his side, he was escorted to the chief clerk's window, where his name was entered in the register, and he was assigned his convict number, 4,140. He was then taken to the receiving room for a bath, photographed and measured in the Bertillon room, and issued his suit of prison gray. Before being led off to his cell, he shook hands with Sheriff Smutzer, thanked him for the excellent treatment he had received in the county jail during the 6 months he had been confined there, and asked him to say a good word for him when his application should come before the parole board in a couple of years. Even before he spent his first night behind the walls of that grim fortress, Ray, as the papers reported, was looking forward to the end of his minimum sentence, when he would be eligible for parole. Conclusion. A mystery never to be fully resolved. 40. Confessions. In their ongoing battle for newsstand supremacy, William Randolph Hearst and his Yellow Press rival Joseph Pulitzer packed their Sunday magazine supplements with the most sensationally attention-grabbing, and often wholly fabricated, stories. One favorite recurrent feature was the confession of a notorious murderer, presented as a major newspaper exclusive, though, more often than not, it was a shameless hoax concocted by some anonymous staff writer. Occasionally, the criminal in question was paid to certify to the authenticity of the piece, though often it was written and disseminated without the consent or even the knowledge of the prisoner who had supposedly provided it. Typical of these brazen frauds was the two-page spread published with much fanfare in the May 9, 1909 Sunday magazine of Pulitzer's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, under the headline, "Confession of Ray Lamphere." "From the moment of his arrest," the story read, "Lamphere, the sphinx of the Ganesse case, had maintained a steadfast silence. Through the tense times following the discovery of the bodies at the Ganesse farm, he refrained from making any statement. He withstood hours of midnight sweating. Recently, however, he had been seen by a staff correspondent from the Sunday Post-Dispatch, to whom, for reasons unexplained by the paper, Ray had decided to unbosom himself. Despite the lurid illustration accompanying the piece, a black-and-white drawing of Ray sneaking down into a creepy cellar hung with drying cuts of meat that might be either ham or human flesh, the confession is little more than a dull rehash of familiar facts, spiced up with a few fabricated revelations. In addition to claiming that Belle had offered to marry me if I would get my life insured, the narrator describes the night when he had unexpectedly returned from Michigan City with John Rye, then proceeded by himself to the Ganesse farm. "I went around to the side of the house, where the cellar steps were, and went into the cellar. Mrs. Ganesse and Helgeline were in the sitting room above. I could hear their voices, and now and then I could catch a word, but I could not tell what they were talking about. Sounds that I heard made me think that Helgeline was sick or drunk. I did not realize it then, but I have no doubt now that the woman had given him poison in beer and that it was beginning to take effect. She always kept bottled beer in the house, and it would have been easy for her to put poison in a glass of beer. I stayed there between half an hour and an hour. All the time I could hear Helgeline making sounds as if he was sick. The next morning Helgeline was not there. Mrs. Ganesh said he had gone home. I did not suspect then that she had killed him. For the first time, the newspaper trumpeted, it had obtained direct testimony proving that Mrs. Ganesh killed her victims by poison. An impressive journalistic coup, had the heralded confession been authentic. Ray would never finish his 2-year minimum sentence. The hemorrhage he suffered on the second day of the trial turned out to be, as his physician had recognized, the sign of incipient tuberculosis. By October 1909, less than a year after his conviction, it was clear that he was dying. Hoping to win Ray's release, his brother-in-law, H.L. Finley of LaPorte, traveled to Indianapolis for a meeting with Governor Thomas R. Marshall, and was informed by Marshall's secretary, Mark Thistlewaite, that the state parole board would not meet until early December. "Lamphere will come home in a box before then," was Finley's grim reply. He then appealed to the governor for an immediate pardon. Taking the matter under advisement, Marshall contacted both Warden James D. Reed of the Indiana State Prison and William Antis, now Sheriff of LaPorte. Reed believed that no good purpose would be served by freeing Lamphere, since in prison he had the best of care and was more comfortable than he would be at home. Antis felt that Lamphere was not deserving of a pardon, for he had not told all he knew about the Ganesh case. He advised that Lamphere remain in prison until he unsealed his lips. According to newspaper reports, authorities, among them State's Attorney Ralph Smith, were convinced that Lamphere will make a confession clearing every detail of the Ganesh Death Farm mystery when he realizes the end is at hand. Their confident prediction proved to be wishful thinking. On Thursday afternoon, December 30th, Ray began to fail so rapidly that, though his sister, Mrs. Finley, was immediately notified by telephone, he was dead by the time she arrived a few hours later. He was 38 years old. "Died with Ganesh mystery unsolved," the Indianapolis News reported on Friday. Whatever knowledge Lamphere had of the night when the Ganesh house was burned to the ground went with him to the grave, for he made no statement before his death that would throw any light on the Ganesh case. Those who expected that he would confess before he died were disappointed, as were also those who expected that in his dying moments he would prove his innocence. That Ray had been acquitted of the murder charges brought against him and died without admitting to any guilt did not prevent a number of newspapers from identifying him in their obituary notices as Ray Lamphere, the slayer of Mrs. Belle Ganesh and her children. Ray's wake was held at his sister's home on Sunday, January 2, 1910. Along with Mrs. Finley and her husband, attendees included Ray's brother and elderly mother. Afterward, his body was transported to Rossville Cemetery for interment. Officiating at the funeral was the Reverend C.R. Parker of the First Baptist Church, who chose as his theme a verse from Genesis 18, dealing with God's righteous destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. During his long incarceration in the LaPorte County Jail while awaiting the start of his trial, Ray had been visited regularly by another man of the cloth, the Reverend Edwin A. Shell, until recently pastor of LaPorte's First Methodist Church. A native of Deer Creek, Indiana, and a graduate of Northwestern University, the 48-year-old Shell, after a distinguished career as a minister, church administrator, and writer for popular magazines, had been appointed president of Iowa Wesleyan University just weeks before the Ganesh fire. On the day of Ray's arrest, he was one of the first people to come speak to the prisoner. Afterward, interviewed by reporters, Shell had vouched for Ray's essentially harmless character. "He is not a vicious man," said Shell. "Just a farmer's son who had picked up a little knowledge of the carpenter's trade and, of course, cannot be expected to rate high mentally. But there is little in his past life to believe that he would be guilty of the crime of firing a house containing 4 people. He is a toper, and his relations to women are open to criticism. But he is not a bad man." In the following weeks, Shell became Ray's closest confidant, engaging him in emotional conversations that sometimes lasted several hours. Badgered by reporters following one of these talks, Shell refused to repeat what Ray had told him, insisting that Lamphere's communications to me are wholly privileged.
On several subsequent occasions, however, Shell could not resist dishing out tantalizing bits of supposedly confidential information, stating unequivocally that the Ganess children were chloroformed before the fire and the woman's body found in the ruins was not that of Mrs. Ganess, who was still alive. Asked about Ray's involvement in the Ganess atrocities, Shell startled his listeners by replying that he was sure that Lamphere was innocent of all but the Helgoline murder, but of the latter he was very jealous. When one reporter asked if Shell was saying that Ray had confessed to the Helgoline murder, Shell clammed up, solemnly declaring, "It would not be right to answer that question, since the facts divulged by Ray were as inviolably sacred as the secrets of the confessional should be." Having hinted so strongly for so long that he was in possession of Ray's darkest secrets, Shell came under renewed pressure to disclose them once Ray was in the ground. As before, he was firm in his refusal. "It is the minister's duty to hear confession and to plead with the criminal to make restitution or urge him to make his statements to the courts," he told reporters on January 10th. "If I should reveal this confidence, the ministry would be discredited and would lose some of their power to do good by hearing confessions. I expect to be criticized whether I decide to reveal the statement or not. The ministry and churchmen will criticize me if I reveal, and others of the public will criticize me if I do not." All in all, Shell said with a sigh, he had come to wish that Ray had never confided in him at all. "I would give $500 if I had not heard the story told me by Lamphere." On Thursday, January 13th, 1910, 3 days after Shell made this statement, the front page of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch carried a startling banner headline. "Confession clears the Ganess mystery. Details of Lamphere's dying statement given to the Post-Dispatch." According to the copyrighted story, which made no mention of the supposedly exclusive confession published by the paper 8 months earlier, days before his death, when he believed eternity was near, Ray Lamphere had unburdened his soul by a confession which clears the Ganess mystery, the crime classic of a generation. The confession, hitherto supposed to have been made only to the Reverend E. A. Shell, was given to a man of unassailable character and truthfulness, whose standing in the community is such that his word is accepted without question. This unimpeachable source, who, for good reasons of his own, insisted on anonymity, had been tracked down by a staff correspondent for the Post-Dispatch in a quest extending over 6 states. The Post-Dispatch staff correspondent fully verified the fact that this man had such an interview with Ray Lamphere as he asserts he had, under conditions as he describes them, the article continued. The confession dictated by Ray had been put into writing at the time it was given. Unfortunately, only one copy was made. That copy, which was left with Lamphere, had evidently disappeared. Nevertheless, though the Post-Dispatch has not been able to find the written record of the confession, it has come into possession of its essential details from such a source that there can be no question of its authenticity. There is no reason to doubt that the statements now made public for the first time are substantially as they fell from the lips of Ray Lamphere. In contrast to the ostensible confession that had appeared the previous May, which offered little in the way of new information, the present one was packed with dramatic revelations. Not long after Ray went to work for Bell, so the story went, a Norwegian man had arrived at the farm in response to one of her matrimonial ads. "This man went to sleep one night and never awoke. In the dark hour before dawn, Mrs. Ganess awakened Lamphere and ordered him to carry something in a gunny sack to the farmyard, where a hole had been dug as an ostensible receptacle for rubbish. The gunny sack and the something in it were tumbled into the hole, and a hummock of earth was shoveled on top of it." Within a month, another man came to the farm, bringing all his money from Wisconsin or Minnesota. A few nights later, there was another burying job for Lamphere. By the time Ray helped dispose of a third corpse-filled gunny sack, he had become a willing accomplice, remunerated for his services with enough money to spend in drinking and gambling in the saloons of LaPorte. Each time Belle expected a new arrival, she would send Ray into town to purchase chloroform,
which she used to kill her victims in their sleep. On those occasions when the chloroform did not of itself kill them, she would sever their heads with a keen-edged axe. Then Andrew Helgeline came, the confession continued. Ordered to move out of the house, Ray waited until Helgeline and Mrs. Ganesse were out driving one day, then snuck back in and bored a hole through the floor of the sitting room in such a position that it would not be discovered, but would enable him to both hear and see what went on in the room. When Mrs. Ganesse sent him to Michigan City on a fictitious errand and told him to stay all night, he suspected that Helgeline's time had come. He returned in the evening against her orders and crept into the cellar. Something Mrs. Ganesse had given Helgeline had made him sick. He was groaning in great distress. "For God's sake, call for a doctor," Lamphere heard him say. But Mrs. Ganesse told him that he would soon be better. Presently he succumbed to the effect of the poison and dropped from his chair to the floor. Lamphere, staring through the hole in the floor, saw Mrs. Ganesse strike the blow that ended Helgeline's life. He went away then, and it was not until the next night that the woman called on him to help her bury a body sewed in a gunny sack. When Lamphere demanded a larger share of the profits, the two quarreled bitterly, and Mrs. Ganesse ordered him off the farm. Repairing to his favorite watering hole, Lamphere began downing whiskies and brooding over the money he felt entitled to. He believed there was not less than $1,500 hidden about the house. The more he drank, the more convinced he became that Mrs. Ganesse had not given him a fair deal. In the early hours of the morning of April 28th, an inebriated Lamphere, equipped with some of the chloroform that had been bought with Mrs. Ganesse's money, and accompanied by a female companion, crept up through the cedars toward the silent house on the hilltop. It was something that Lamphere, sober, would not have undertaken, but Lamphere, drunk, had enough bravado to essay it. The Ganesse dog, which would have set up a racket at the intrusion of a stranger, was silenced with a word from the familiar ex-farmhand. Sneaking into the bedrooms of Mrs. Ganesse and her children, Lamphere, who had learned the technique from his former employer, chloroformed them all. Then he and his companion ransacked the house by candlelight. Much to their disappointment, they found less than $70. By then dawn was beginning to break. Abandoning the search, they hurried away. As Lamphere headed toward the farm, where he was to work that day, he looked back and saw smoke and flames bursting from the house on the hill. Ray insisted that he did not intentionally start the fire. He did not desire the death of the Ganesse children. He was not such a monster that he could wish to burn sleeping children in their beds. He did not even intend to kill Mrs. Ganesse. Apparently he had unwittingly left a burning candle behind, which sparked the conflagration. Foremost among the facts supposedly established by the confession was that Mrs. Ganesse is dead. The adult body found in the smoking ruins of the Ganesse farmhouse was the body of Mrs. Belle Ganesse. She was under the influence of chloroform when the smoke crept up through the crevices and smothered her. She died with the head of her little boy pillowed on her breast. He, too, was chloroformed and died without waking. Neither of them knew aught of it when the two little girls, Myrtle and Lucy, not so thoroughly chloroformed as the woman and boy, awoke to their peril and ran into their mother's room and threw themselves on the woman, beseeching help. They perished there with the woman and the boy, mercifully suffocated by the smoke before the flames came licking at the tender flesh. There was another, perhaps even more startling, revelation. When Ray snuck into the Ganesse farmhouse that night, he had found a fifth person asleep in one of the bedrooms, Jenny Olson. Mrs. Ganesse had, in fact, sent Jenny away to school in California for a time, but she had returned, and Mrs. Ganesse, for reasons of her own, had kept her concealed in the house. Lamphere found her when he went there that night, and chloroformed her, and she died as she lay in her bed. With her slender body, the flames did their work so well that the searchers raking the hot debris the next day found only the other four bodies. As for the girl exhumed from the Ganesse graveyard and widely assumed to be Jenny, her identity added another mystery to the case. Ray's purported confession made headlines in newspapers across the country,
from the Los Angeles Herald to the New York Times. In LaPorte, reaction was uniformly dismissive. "No one here believes the tale," reported the correspondent for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Both Wirt Warden and Ralph Vince Smith scoffed at every supposed revelation, deriding the entire account as a story of the cock-and-bull variety. Pressed to reveal the source of the confession, the editor of the Post-Dispatch stood by his refusal to disclose the person's name, defending his decision on the basis of long-standing journalistic practice. "In newspaper offices," he wrote, "it is well known that valuable information is often obtained under an inviolable pledge of confidence, and that such a pledge is never broken unless the newspaper is released by the person to whom it is made. The name of the man who received the confession from Lamphere will never be made known by the Post-Dispatch unless permission is given by this man, which seems highly improbable." He did, however, drop a very strong hint as to the identity of his anonymous source, declaring that "the Reverend Mr. Shell could verify the confession if he would consent to break his silence." Besieged by reporters at his home in Burlington, Iowa, on Friday, January 14th, Shell reiterated that he had not divulged any such confession to any person. The following day, however, he succumbed to the pressure. Summoning a reporter from the Chicago Tribune to his office at Iowa Wesleyan University, the pastor finally broke his long silence, dictating a statement that appeared on the front page of the next day's edition under the headline, "Dr. Shell Bears Lamphere's Secret." "In view of the conflicting reports which continue to keep alive interest in the Ganess case," Shell began, "and the interrogations which must continually arise in the minds of sorrowing friends, and recognizing that the principal facts already are made public, I have concluded to relieve myself of further responsibility by communicating to the public through the Chicago Tribune the details of my three conversations with the late Ray Lamphere in the jail at LaPorte, the statements he made to me, and the circumstances under which they were made." Shell recalled first hearing about the fire at the Ganess house on the next to the last Monday morning of April 1908, and described his sorrow at learning of the death of the three children, "who had been attending my Sunday school, a bright, winsome lad 5 years old, and two girls, perhaps 7 and 9. I had seen the children driving around in a pony cart the previous fall, and several times noticed the boy in the infant class. At the suggestion of J.P. Ruppel, the Sunday school superintendent, we arranged a brief memorial service for the Sunday school the following Sunday morning." A few days later, Ray Lamphere was arrested. That Friday, "at the suggestion of Prosecuting Attorney Smith, and understanding it was Lamphere's wish, I called at the jail to counsel with him and perhaps to receive his confession." Lamphere, said Shell, "was agitated in the extreme. Beads of perspiration were on his brow, his hands twitched, and his nervousness was plainly noticeable. He said that he supposed they would hang him, but that he was innocent of murder." During that first conversation, Lamphere denied that he set the house on fire, and related to me how he had slept at the house of a negress until 3 a.m. that morning, then had started for the home of a relative in the country, and in passing by the Ganess home had seen that it was burning, but being angry at Mrs. Ganess and no longer working for her, he hurried past. He then said he reached his relative's place in the country some 4 miles further, at about 4 o'clock. After leaving Lamphere, Shell made some inquiries, then returned to the jail, early after dinner the same day, and told him I had learned that he had not reached his relative until after 6 o'clock that morning. Confronted with this inconsistency, Ray now said that on thinking it over, he remembered that he went back to bed after waking up at 3 a.m., and that the negress got his breakfast about 4 o'clock a.m., and that he did not start as early as he thought, as he remembered the Lake Erie train went by just as he crossed the track north of the lake. He also said that instead of going directly by the house, as he had said in the morning, he had taken the road farther east and on the other side of the lake, and only saw the house at a distance. Gently chiding Lamphere for prevaricating, Shell advised him that if he wanted my sympathy, prayers, and help, to remain silent or tell the exact truth, I promised not to tell the prosecuting attorney. The two men then engaged in general conversation about Mrs. Ganesse. Finally, after some 2 hours,